Good afternoon, White Plaza.
Hey.
Good afternoon, White Plaza. This is Green Grid Radio, and we are broadcasting live out here in White Plaza today.
Are we live yet, Adam?
We are live.
Oh, we're live. Hey, KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. This is Green Grid Radio.
We are broadcasting live. We have a very special episode for you listeners today. We are broadcasting live from White Plaza for Stanford Energy Week. Stanford Energy Week is, this is the energy showcase today, and there's lots of student groups out here making lots of noise, but that's actually not related to Stanford Energy Week. Stanford Energy Week is a showcase of energy groups at Stanford and research posters and a celebration of energy timed really nicely to go with Earth Day and Al Gore's visit to campus next week. And some other events on campus. Do you know all the events coming up, Eric?
I think so. So, as you said, this is Stanford Energy Week, and coming up on Monday is the Celebrating Sustainability Festival. It's on Earth Day, and it will take place in the Engineering Quad. And as always, Green Grid Radio will be there, not to broadcast, but to mingle and learn. And also on Tuesday next week at 7 p.m., Vice President Al Gore will give a speech in Memorial Auditorium. Tickets, I think it's sold out, but students, if you get there before 6:30, you should be able to find a seat. I want to plug something a little bit unrelated as well. Coming up this weekend in Memorial Auditorium, the phenomenal play musical Spring Awakening. I went last week, and it was truly amazing to see Stanford students perform and sing and dance and even make love on stage.
Wow.
So if you want to see this, you should go to Memorial Auditorium on either Thursday, Friday, or Saturday at 8 p.m. You can also get your tickets either there in the door or online at musical.stanford.edu. So that is Spring Awakening.
A few more announcements here. Because we're just trying to help everyone out. See the Escape El Nino study abroad. We have the Bing Overseas people are out here. They are promoting the Bing Overseas programs. I have to say from personal experience, the Bing Overseas program was one of the best things it is in undergrad here. So check that out. I'd also recommend all of you passersby who aren't completely overwhelmed by all the sound and noise coming from everywhere in every direction, that there's a bunch of companies over on the balcony of the bookstore here in White Plaza, and there's some cool stuff over there. I haven't checked it out just yet, but I got some postcards here. There's a free cookies being given away by Hampton Creek Foods, and they're all about reducing the ratio of energy input to food energy output. So maybe this is a good entrance point into our discussion. So today on the program, as we embark upon the nuts and bolts of the show here, we have a special guest. We have Ms. Deborah Dunn, who is an associate consulting professor here at Stanford University in the D School, and maybe I'll let Eric introduce her.
Or why don't we let Deborah introduce herself? Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Eric.
First of all, welcome back to Stanford. You were abroad, not through the Bing Overseas program, but for something else last week. Tell us about that.
Last week I was in Oxford in the UK attending the School World Forum for Social Entrepreneurship, which is an annual event. It draws about 1,000 people from all over the world who are either social entrepreneurs or other people interested in supporting social entrepreneurs in various ways. And I have to say it's one of the most extraordinary things that I do every year, to hang out with these amazing people doing really impressive work around the world.
So the way you got involved with that conference is because you're one of the board of the Skoll organization, right?
I am. I'm on the board of the Skoll Foundation, and we have been around a little over 10 years now supporting the work of social entrepreneurs.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why Deborah is with us today. She's also a D School professor and faculty there. She's on the board of B Lab, which supports companies that wants to pursue more values than just simply profit. And at the D School, you are a part of something called the Feed Collaborative. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, so actually, I'm really, really excited about the way technology is beginning to disrupt education and make it possible to really transform the educational experience on the campus. And the Feed Collaborative is related to that. Matt Roth, my colleague, and I are both very interested in the food system and working with students who are interested in various aspects of getting to a more sustainable food system. And through the Feed Collaborative, we are partnering with organizations in the community who are doing work on various aspects of the food system and doing projects with them, connecting students to do work on the ground, trying to transfer knowledge around entrepreneurship and design thinking. So it's pretty early going. And with students like Eric, we're really trying to co-create this idea, but I'm really excited about it.
So, Deborah, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to the idea of starting the Feed Collaborative?
Well, I've been teaching at the D School pretty much since the beginning, and I think one of the things that distinguishes the D School is that all of our classes involve real projects, working with real organizations on real issues. And I've been doing a lot of work around food. So one of the limitations, I think, of our project work has been we're on a quarter system, and in 10 weeks, students can do a great job of identifying real needs and prototyping early solutions, but it's hard to really get to the implementation phase and get very far along. So our idea was that if we built deeper connections with organizations who we would work with on a multi-quarter basis and enable students who were really interested to come back and do another quarter, maybe working more on an independent study basis to continue their work and continue implementation, we could move from education to really trying to have more impact.
Yeah, that sounds good. We're also joined by one of the students in that is a part of the classes taught at the Feed Collaborative. So I'm one of them. I'm also joined by my classmate. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Can you get a little closer to the microphone?
Should I just? Oh,
yeah.
Great.
I think
Hi.
Deborah and Sarah, you like each other. You can share that one.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Yeah. So Sarah, you're a grad student here in the Environmental and Engineering program.
Yes.
Yes, and before that you went to University of Virginia, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And why did you choose, first of all, to attend the class at the D School and then to stick around and work with the Feed Collaborative?
Well, I chose the class at the D School because I was really looking for a different kind of classroom or non-classroom experience. And I've kind of been interested in food my whole life. So the DSA class seemed like a logical choice, and I stuck with it because it was such an amazing way to get outside of school and to go to East Palo Alto and meet different people that I would never have otherwise had a chance to meet. And the people that I met, I was really inspired by them, and so I'm really excited to continue collaborating with the people that we met and working on tackling these big challenges.
So I'm curious, can you describe in a bit more detail, what kinds of projects are you actually doing through this class and through this collaborative?
So one big project that we're working on is collaborating with youth sports organizations in East Palo Alto, specifically the Mastodons, which is the youth football program. And we're working with the coach to really improve the players' nutrition and use youth sports as a platform for improving nutrition education for youth in general.
All right.
So I want to cut in here and just remind all of you out here in White Plaza and all the listeners at home that we are broadcasting live from White Plaza. This is Green Grid Radio, one of KZSU's news public affairs storytelling programs. And we have a few opportunities for you all to engage with us. We have some questions here. We have post-it notes. You can come up here and write some questions for the panel. that we can discuss. We're here until 1 o'clock. If you have an interest in food and energy, we're about to really dive into that headlong right now. Also, we have stickers. We have KCSU stickers, and we have a T-shirt that we're going to be giving away here. So come by the tent. Come say hello. Come check us out. We're here in White Plaza. And let's dive back into the conversation with our guests, Sarah and Ms. Dunn.
Yeah. Thank you, Adam. And as he said, we're in White Plaza, and that's not, of course, our usual spot for airing our show. And the reason we're here is because this is the Stanford Energy Week. And I want to direct my question to Deborah next. You seem to be working a lot in sort of the intersect between sustainability and food. But what does that really have to do with energy?
Well, as it turns out, food is related to sustainability in many ways, but specifically in terms of energy. If you look back many decades, most of the energy that went into producing the food that all humans eat came from the sun. And so fossil fuels were really not part of the equation. But as we wanted to increase production and move beyond the natural limits of nature, we started to create an energy-intense food system. So today, energy goes into almost every aspect of commercial food production. Fossil fuels are intensively used in making fertilizers and pesticides to enrich the soil. There's significant transportation that occurs to move food around. The processing of food, which for much of the food that Americans eat is very intensive, involves energy to operate the machinery and dry the food and process it in various ways. So today it's estimated that fully 10% of the energy consumed is consumed through the food system, which is a very, very significant impact.
Yeah, and speaking, I study atmospheric impacts as well as energy sources, and specifically talking about food waste. I think this is another huge thing, because the amount of waste that we produce through food goes into our landfills, and or is assuming that the majority of the world is not composting, which I think is the case. Or the majority of the developed world is not composting too much. That has significant methane and greenhouse gas implications as well, which is just sort of feeding some of the challenges that we're now facing. So,
and on the topic of waste, factory farming of animals produces huge waste streams with very, very significant methane content as well. So again, contrasting the more natural historic approach where you used animals in the same context as growing crops, the waste fertilized the soil and maintained soil fertility. Now we've not only diminished soil fertility, requiring the use of fossil fuels to continue to fertilize artificially, but we've also created these giant toxic waste streams that we now have to process and manage.
Yeah, and we seem to have almost built ourselves into a trap. And of course, there are many different ways to take ourselves out of that. And if we exclude the version which is stop eating, what do you see are some ways forward? I mean, should we talk about reducing waste, or are there other things that you see?
Well, you know, one of the reasons that I have focused a lot on food over the past few years is that I'm interested in sustainability from a very human behavioral perspective, and we all make lots of choices about the food that we eat every day. And through those choices, we're deciding how much our own behavior consumes energy through food. It involves the use of pesticides and fertilizers and other things. And so when I can, I buy organic food. And I, for both health and preference reasons, avoid processed food. So one of the things that I think is great about the area of food is We all eat every day, usually multiple times, and we have many opportunities to minimize the waste of food and also influence all of these other factors through the food that we choose.
Yeah, and I think you're making a great point here. This is one of the areas in our lives where we can have a pretty large personal impact. But then again, we are creatures in a system, and we're sort of constrained by the food system that we live in. I mean, I only know certain ways to get my food, which is, for, in my case, to go to the store, and has been transported there. What do you think are some improvements that could be done to the food system?
Well, you know, we're lucky to live in the Bay Area, where some of the most pioneering work in the food system is being done. So in terms of real choices that we all have every day and every week, you know, I buy virtually all of my produce at the farmer's market. And the farmer's market is in Palo Alto 12 months a year. The farmers come from not far away to bring their food, so there's some transportation involved, but it's less. I choose organic products there. So while, yes, we are confronted with the big ag food system every day, we also have other options available without huge inconvenience in the immediate area in which we live. In other parts of the country, I think it's more difficult.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you bring up sort of the local aspect of food production, because it's a topic that we have discussed at length in our class and in our different workshops that we have. And in preparation of this show, we took a look at an article in the Scientific American that argues sort of the opposite, that the local food movement is not a solution to the energy problem, because it increases the amount of energy that needs to go into each unit of food. So let's assume that this is true. We cannot know for sure. This is just one person claiming this. But what are some other benefits of the local food than just simply less energy usage?
You know, for me, increasingly, as I think about what gives me gratification and makes me satisfied about my life, part of it is connection to people. And so one of the things I love about shopping locally and buying from people who are raising my food is I establish connections with those people. And going to Safeway, which I've done one or two times, it is a kind of horrifying experience for me. It's not a pleasant space, and it's like drudgery to go there. But when I go and buy from people I really like, and they say, wow, try these amazing flowering kale sprouts this week. They're great. You've never had them before. I look forward to going, and it's not just about obtaining food, but it's a generally pleasant community experience.
Yeah, it's not about the destination, but the process of even acquiring and cooking, and there's a lot we can work on, and rather than just thinking about mechanically, oh, I need to eat food, I need to go acquire the food, I need to take it home with me. But one of these things, one of the things that I've been thinking about since you've been discussing this, I know it would be great for me as a student. Let's say I'm on campus, I have no car, I'm an undergraduate, I live in the dorms. How do I make the conscious choices in my life when the access to something like the farmer's market is not so easy? That seems like a challenge to me still.
Well, even to get into a really controversial topic, even if you're eating in the dorm, you have the choice about which foods to eat. You have a choice about how much meat do you eat versus other products. They try to buy at least part of the meat served in the dorms from farmers who are raising it with grass feeding as opposed to commercial feeding. And so you have choices about those things even here on the dorm. And I think part of the challenge is to become a little educated and informed about how these various food choices impact the environment and energy consumption.
So maybe we'll we get Sarah involved here. Sarah, you're a vegetarian, right?
Correct.
So, what going off of what Deborah just said, there's definite energy impacts. There's health impacts to making these kinds of choices and determining how much meat we want to eat in the dining halls and so on. So I want to hear about your experience, why you chose to become a vegetarian, and what it means to you, and also maybe about how easy or difficult it was back in Virginia for you.
Okay. I've been vegetarian since about seventh grade. I grew up in a house where my father was also vegetarian, so I was kind of exposed to a lot of non-meat types of meals, and so it was a pretty easy transition for me to make. But yeah, in college, especially living in the dorm, was much more difficult. But once I had my own apartment, it was a lot easier to make those choices for myself. And I think when I initially became vegetarian, a lot of it was moral and really thinking about animal rights. And I do think those issues are really important, but as I kind of became more mature and learned more and read more, it really became more of an environmental issue and the issues with waste creation and pollution issues. Now in Virginia, it was actually pretty easy. I mean, you just have to want to do it and you can find the places, but it does take a conscious effort to seek out, a variety of different foods and to not end up just eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for every meal.
And Deborah touched upon this a little bit earlier. There are not only environmental or ethical benefits to being vegetarian or being more conscious about what kinds of food you get, there are also health benefits that I'm sure you know. And you have your own experiences to talk from, but you also been doing work in East Palo Alto with students that would definitely not consider becoming vegetarians. How do we communicate sort of the benefits of changing their eating habits for their own sake? Because that would, of course, then have great spillover effects on the environmental issue as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've clearly been tackling this difficult challenge, and I think the hardest thing is that for someone to really want to change the way that they act, they have to have a firsthand experience of the benefit of changing. And so that can be really difficult to give. But I think in terms of motivating kids to change, using people that they look up to and, you know, maybe their parents or their role models or the sports players that they look up to, and if those people could kind of present that message, I think that could be one really effective way to create change.
I want to jump in with another point that came up at the Skoll World Forum. So Mohamed Yunus was there, as he often is, and he received an award this year. And one of the things that he said that really resonated with me was, we have had science fiction forever, and science fiction is really important in giving us ideas that then become reality. And we can think of lots of examples of that. But we don't really have social fiction. We don't imagine what the world could be from a social perspective. And he really challenged the group to start imagining the kind of social fabric that we want to make the planet the kind of place that we want to live. And I think things like this would be part of that. So I think that's an exciting opportunity that Stanford students could play a big role in.
Yeah, I heard about that keynote speech as well, and it sounds quite inspiring. So I'd like to take the moment and break the fourth wall here and motivate all of you in my plaza to write the next piece of social fiction, not science fiction. We need social help right now, just as much as we need the scientific and tech innovations these days. I just want to take a quick break here to remind everyone what this is. This is Green Grid Radio. We're broadcasting live in White Plaza for Stanford Energy Showcase. We actually are broadcasting on solar power as well to tie in everything that we're talking about, energy, to show that we're walking the walk as well. many thanks to our KZSU crew who's helped us out with the event. Mark Lawrence, chief engineer, Mayan Dembo, and Katie Straw back at the station helping us pull the strings. Thank you guys for helping out. And again, I'd like to thank Stanford Energy Club for putting on this event, highlighting energy, the importance in our daily lives, and just calling attention to it. We're gonna move back into the panel discussion. This is Adam Pearson here. I'm joined with Eric Olison, one of our other producers. And I can't believe I forgot Diane Wu is also here helping out with the technical elements, with the production elements and everything. So I was saying we have Ms. Deborah Dunn and we have Sarah Triolo here as our panelists, and we're having a discussion. We'll be here until 1 o'clock finishing this up. I wanted to take a moment and acknowledge that we have received some questions from the audience. So we're gonna start to go through those, and I want to invite you, if you are interested in food and energy or the conversation we've been having so far, please come up and find out more about the program or to give us your question, and we'll happily address them, hopefully with time permitting. So here's a question from the audience. California is one story about this sustainable food and everything, but how do we manage sustainable food production in the developing countries or in countries or regional locations with a harsh winter?
So let's start with the developing country example. Frankly, in developing countries, organic approaches to agriculture have been the norm until fairly recently and continue to be the norm with a lot of small shareholder farmers, partly because they can't afford fertilizers and they can't afford some of the higher tech things. And so we're now at a point where there's a search for increasing yields, and there's a transition underway, and there's an active choice about what direction those countries head in. And in places like India specifically, there are major activists really advocating for the continuation of organic practices. So the debate about whether we can feed the planet without big ag is a lively and active debate. And as with any debate, you can find people on either side who argue vociferously with their facts, saying one side is true or the other is true. I've seen plenty of evidence that gives me quite a bit of hope that we can go a very long way toward feeding the planet with organic and sustainable practices and with some of the behavioral changes that we've been talking about. So I think we need some of that social fiction to play part of the role. So that's the developing country view. In terms of cold climates, so I think that it's not reasonable to assume that all food is ultra local. That doesn't seem, you know, Eric would probably agree with that coming from Sweden.
Yeah, because I like oranges, bananas, apples, cantaloupe. Yeah.
However, whether or not we're all growing our own food, we still have choices about the food system that's producing the food that's shipped around to feed people in various places. And if you read the work of people like Joel Salatin, who's a big advocate of integrated organic techniques, many of those people argue that you can get quite high yields with a very different model of farming that, again, wouldn't have to be hyper-local. There could still be some exportation between states and even between countries.
I wanted to just sort of react to one of the things you said in there. You're optimistic about the potential for not using traditional or not using fertilizers in developing worlds. And this is a point that I sometimes forget, having grown up in the 90s and everything. But before the Industrial Revolution, there was only organic farming, right?
Exactly.
we've been doing
exactly.
It for thousands of years. We know how to do it. It's not like there's like some amnesia where we've forgotten how to do organic farming. It's just it's a choice to not use the environmentally intensive technologies or the specific fertilizers in question, and to utilize the tools that Big Ag supplies, it's a conscious choice, and it's a choice that we can make. It's just, I think, encouraging and motivating and demonstrating powerfully to people who are making these choices, not like governments. We're talking about the farmers themselves.
Right.
Right.
And I think a lot of people might react to that argument by saying, well, there hasn't been 7 billion people on Earth before, so we need this now. And I think that's wrong, too. If we were to just share the resources we have, we'd all be going to bed full, not hungry.
And this gets back to Adam's point about food waste. I mean, we probably waste enough food in this country to feed several countries. So if we struck a better balance in terms of actually consuming what we take, that would be very helpful.
And if one of our listeners or any of you are really interested in the issue of food waste, Diane Wu, our phenomenal producer, will do a show on that later on this season. I know it's going to be great, so make sure to tune in for that.
Nice plug. I think the statistic that I heard, which is shocking and probably even an underestimate, to be honest, is that 40% of what we produce is wasted. And it's funny. It's one of those things. I'm not thinking of another good example, but there's sometimes moments in your life where you think about something, and then it changes the way you think about that forever. And so for me, when I realized or when I first thought, oh, food waste, this is like a serious environmental, energy, human, social impacts. Like now, I can't not think about it. You know, like when you go to events and then half the treehouse burrito that's like 20 feet long is thrown out, you're like, wow, this is really bad. Or you know, can't we like drop this off somewhere else where people would eat it? Or you know, it just makes you super hypersensitive to these things. And I really want to open the rest of the campus to think about these things more frequently, as well as the dining halls. I mean, I don't want to upset Stanford administrative people, but I think there's something extremely dubious and definitely wrong structurally in the format of having a buffet for every meal on campus. I think it really puts the incentives in the wrong space, because I remember when I was a freshman and I was less engaged in these topics, or I didn't even think about it. But you know, you just go, you'd get like a sandwich, and then you'd eat a few bites and say, oh, I don't want this, and then you just compost it. I mean, it's great that you can compost it, but the problem is, like, somebody would have eaten that 90% of that sandwich or something. And I really encourage and I want Stanford from a like very high level to think about this, because I know that, you know, the buffet allows the dining halls to make a lot of money and everything, but it's just like, from the perspective of waste, from the perspective of student happiness, I think that we really need to restructure the payment system for the dining halls. And that's just like my rant for the day.
Yeah, so this issue of food waste just kind of makes me think about the broader issue of the way that the majority of people, at least in the United States, have become totally separated from food production and then dealing with food waste. So it's really easy to go buy a sandwich or to go to the dining hall and eat at the buffet and then put your leftovers elsewhere, or, you know, in the compost, and then never think about it again. And again, this is a really big challenge, because how do you get people more involved in the production and then dealing with the waste side of things? Because, you know, those are much more difficult and a little dirtier tasks. But if we had a better understanding of how those things worked, I think we'd be more conscious of the way that we eat.
And this sort of segues into our next question, because one of the reasons why we in the U.S. can't throw away food is because we can afford it. We don't care, because
it's subsidized. Yeah. So it's like nothing. And the cost of food is nothing.
Yeah, we have a lot of money, and the food for us is cheap, whereas in other parts of the world, it is not. And we have a question here from the audience. What about class and food? What if I can't afford the money or the time to shop at, for example, the farmer's market only? What are some? What would be the solution for a person like that?
So, this is definitely a legitimate issue at the top level. So, The alternative food movement, frankly, has been a pretty affluent movement. And shopping at Whole Foods, which is a nice thing to do, is a very expensive thing to do, and certainly not everyone can afford that. However, that said, we still have a lot of choices that are made about the foods that we eat, regardless of where we buy them. And in areas like East Palo Alto, where we're working, which is nationally classified as a food desert, there is less access to fresh produce and other things, fresh, healthy food, although you can find it if you look for it there. But certainly for all of us on campus, we have choices about, do we eat fruits and vegetables? Do we eat heavily processed foods? At that level, I don't really think the class thing is a legitimate reason for saying, I don't have any options here. And it is the case that in many communities, people have gotten very creative about making available fresh, healthy, organic food at low price. The food co-op movement, which I was involved in when I graduated from college, is still alive and well in many communities. And you can be part of a group buying effort that reduces prices. So it takes some effort. It takes looking around. But I think the reality is we all have a lot of options here.
So we have another question from the audience that we want to take. This one is about some confusion between organic versus sustainable practices. Organic food production might still destroy the soil. So if you look at the Middle East 2,000 years ago, the intensive agricultural processes may have affected the landscape and may have influenced the desert region today. So how do we ensure that if we are advocating for organic food production, that it will still be sustainable for the planet?
Yeah, so I think that's a very legitimate point. And I think one of the challenges and the frustrations is that organic, like almost any other label in this country, becomes a marketing thing. And a lot of companies are motivated to sell as many products as possible. And so they'll get the organic label by going through the minimum necessary steps and do that not necessarily as part of a commitment to sustainability, but as a way to sell more products. So at the end of the day, this is a complex systems level issue. It's about maintaining soil fertility. It's about managing water. It's about all of these other environmental factors that today we frankly don't have a lot of great measurement and transparency around how all of that is done. And I think that's an issue that we need to really begin to tackle to give people more access to really what is the impact at a systemic level of the way various forms of agriculture are done. But in the meantime, you have the impacts that you have the option to choose to have. And so for me, at least organic is not using toxic pesticides and toxic fertilizers. I just started beekeeping. And, you know, we have a crisis in this country because all the bees are dying. One of the reasons they're dying, it is believed, is because so many pesticides are in use everywhere. And so organic is not the be-all, end-all. There are other issues, but it's a step.
Thank you. That was a great answer. And I also like that you sort of bring up the systemic issues behind all of those things. And it's surfaced in several of the answers we've heard. Adam mentioned that the dining halls make money out of having buffets. And you mentioned companies just claiming to be organic to make more profits. And maybe there's a systemic change in the way how we sort of supply food or supply services. And I was hoping to ask, did you see anything at the Skoll World Forum last week of people, entrepreneurs, or just innovators that are challenging the way we believe is most efficient to do business?
Yes, the whole theme of sustainable business is one of the big themes that was addressed at the forum. And there are a number of people working on forms of business, new forms of business that are more transparent and that embrace not just profit, but also positive social and environmental impact. B Lab is one of those. B Corps are the corporate form that I'm personally involved in. But there are a number of other organizations that are working with the financial sector to try to drive them to push mainstream companies to be more transparent about the impact that they're having. So I think the good news is this is an issue that's acknowledged as a huge problem by many, many people, and lots of people are working on it. And there's a lot of power concentrated in big companies, and they fight hard to avoid being forced toward greater transparency. And so it's going to be a long battle, but it's one that we have to keep really pushing on.
This battle sort of, I'm going to make an analogy to directly energy and electricity. Big Ag, it's sort of like Shell or BP or something. Why is Big Ag going to want to sort of implement these organic, you know, processes where they have a direct incentive to continue doing what they're doing and push everyone out of the way to do so, while same as the oil companies are going to do everything they can to, you know, continue to provide oil and politically make it that kind of climate. So I just want to acknowledge that this is a huge systemic problem at every level, like lobbying and so on.
I agree with that, and the reality is, from my perspective, there are two things that change the behavior of Big Ag. One is consumer demand, and we all play a role in that. So if we start demanding a different kind of food out of the food system, then they will respond. If you look specifically at the production of meat, I think this is one of the few areas that may be a naive statement, but it seems to me one of the extreme areas where the only way current practices can exist is lack of transparency. Because most consumers just would not tolerate the things that are done in the factory farming of meat, but it's kept very secretive. And so as consumers, we play a role, and then we need more regulation, which with our current government is a tricky issue. But again, the government is the voice of us. We all vote for these people, and we just need to keep throwing them out till we get some people who do something that makes sense.
This is for anyone on this panel. I want to hear some of these extreme practices that consumers would not tolerate from meat production.
Well, I cannot talk from experience. I'm not a farmer. I am, although an educated consumer, I would call myself, and there are a couple of good documentaries that I would recommend people to watch. One is Food Inc. Another one is American Meat, which is about the specific issue of raising meat and agriculture. Another great one that is similar to this issue is the documentary called Gasland, and that is not about food and agriculture, but about the extraction of natural gas and the harmful about that. There's also a, Diana, you tell me, this is a documentary called Dive about dumpster diving. And I would recommend you to watch that as well. Sarah and Deborah, do you have anything to add?
Well, what came to my mind was the recent kind of scandal with the pink slime chicken nugget meat, right? Well, and it's interesting because, you know, immediately it caused this, people see that and they think that it's really disgusting. But again, it's really hard to make those kind of things stick in people's minds for the long term. You're immediately outraged, and then something else 5 minutes later makes you outraged about something else, and then you
find yourself at McDonald's a week later. Yeah.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, so just to add a couple quick points. One other thing I would recommend is Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer is a good book on this topic. He's done quite a lot of research. But whether you're thinking about the treatment of animals, which is abhorrent in factory farming, or the health effects, as Sarah said. I mean, some of the stuff that gets served as meat, the bacterial issues, I mean, there are just all kinds of health issues, would not be tolerated, but they're not visible.
Exactly, and it's scary because I can sometimes walk around and feel like I have no idea what I've been putting into my body the last 25 years, and a little scared about how I'll feel in 50 years, because I'm sort of in the midst, I grew up in the midst of deregulation and total beliefs in that companies would provide the best for everyone, which we start to question now, and we'll see how I feel in 25 years.
Okay, so let's say I'm an athlete here. I need to eat a lot of protein. I need to work out a lot. I want to be informed, but it's just a reality that I need to be putting on my guns or something. And so how do I live in a way that is not so harmful to the planet and will keep me healthy and happy?
So this is an extreme example, but I was quite amazed to learn that there is a large community of vegan bodybuilders. So the idea that you can only have guns if you eat meat, I think, has been dispelled.
Great.
All right, I think we cannot possibly end the show with a better quote than that.
Guns to dispel. Yeah. Well, I wanna thank our panelists. Thank you, Deborah and Sarah, for being on the program today in White Plaza. It's been a lot of fun. We've had a great, great conversation about food and energy and sustainability here in the local sphere, but also in abstract, broader terms.
Yeah. And if any of our listeners happen to tune in late into our show, this is Green Grid Radio, and we will re-air this tomorrow at our usual time, which is 6 to 7 p.m. On KCC Stanford 90.1 FM.
Yeah, a few more things I want to announce here. So Green Grid Radio is always looking for new talent and new support. So if you have any interest in volunteering, or if this show is of any significance to you at all here in White Plaza or at home, if you're here today, we have some pamphlets out here. You can come talk to us. We'd love to hear from you. Or if you're at home, check out our website. We have something going. We have like a form that's about to go live, and you can fill it out, and we can get in touch with you that way. We're not only looking for students. We're looking for everyone in the community, anyone who has any interest in environmental journalism, environmental topics, learning more about how to communicate some of these challenges to the public and discuss these things in a meaningful manner.
Yeah, and simply be a part of a group of students and others who create and write the social fiction that we so desperately need. Our website is on www.greengridradio.org, so check that out. You can also follow us on Twitter at Green Grid Radio. And before we end today's show, I once again just want to plug the amazing Spring Awakening musical. Go check it out on Thursday, Friday, or Saturday, 8 p.m. in Memorial Auditorium.
Thank you again to the Stanford Energy Club, and check out our solar-powered radio station that's on the mobile here in White Plaza. Have a terrific rest of your afternoon. Again, and also check out the Sustainability Fair on Monday. We'll be there. We'll have a table, and you'll be able to come talk to us then, too. It's Earth Day. Check out Al Gore. And also Connecting the Dots, the energy conference on Friday afternoon here at the Arriaga Alumni Center. Lots of really exciting energy and environment stuff coming up. Come up to us to find out more, or just talk to any of the Stanford Energy Club folks. This is KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM.